Welcome to the Character Cure. I'm Dr. Paul Miller. Courage, Part 1. Of the four cardinal virtues, practical wisdom, courage, self-mastery, and justice, courage is probably the most familiar. It's a mostly uncontroversial virtue that everyone can understand, one that most of us strive to cultivate. To come out on top of your life's challenges, you need courage. The very nature of life requires courage, even when you lack confidence and see very little hope of success or personal reward, sometimes against all odds. Courage is one of the four character cornerstones for a happy and successful life. Before turning to Aristotle for a formal definition of courage, let's begin with some popular examples from Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. We'll start with Frodo, a small hobbit of the Shire. After a perilous journey, during which he carries the Ring of Power to the Valley of the Elves, Frodo is summoned to a secret council by Elrond, Lord of the Elves. Members of the council debate over what they should do with the ring. Ultimately, they agree with Gandalf the Wizard that the ring should be destroyed in the fires of Mordor, where it was originally forged. They all know the journey to Mount Doom will be risky and fraught with danger. Elrond explains to the council, "The road must be trod, but it will be very hard, and neither strength nor wisdom will carry us far upon it. This quest may be attempted by the weak, with as much hope as the strong. Yet such is oft the course of deeds that move the wills of the world. Small hands do them, because they must, while the eyes of the great are elsewhere." This statement captures one of the main themes of Tolkien's masterpiece, the unexpected power of courage found within those who are comparatively weak. While Frodo longs to stay in Rivendell, the peaceful and well-fortified Valley of the Elves, he finds his courage and announces in his small voice, "I will take the ring, although I do not know the way." Elrond gives his approval to Frodo as the ring bearer. "I think that this task is appointed for you, Frodo, and that if you do not find a way, no one will." Near the end of the journey, with their physical and emotional strength almost spent, Frodo's loyal companion, fellow hobbit Samwise Gamgee, displays his own courage. Speaking of the heavy burden of the Ring of Power, he says to Frodo, "I can't carry it for you, but I can carry you and it as well. So up you get." He then carries Frodo up the mountain until Frodo regains a portion of his strength. Both hobbits then crawl the rest of the way to the fires of Mordor. The Lord of the Rings sheds light on what courage looks like in the face of almost insurmountable odds. While the battles for Middle-earth are dominated by men, Tolkien also accentuates the courage of women. Eowyn, the niece of King Theoden, disguises herself and joins the riders of Rohan in battle. The climax of her courage comes when she stares down the Lord of the Nazgûl, who announces that he cannot be killed by any living man. Eowyn replies, "But no living man am I. You look upon a woman. Eowyn I am, Eowyn's daughter. You stand between me and my lord and kin. Begone if you be not deathless." As she strikes with her sword and kills the Nazgûl, Eowyn inspires her companion Merry, another hobbit who embraces what Tolkien describes as the slow-kindled courage of his race. Together, Merry and Eowyn go on to defeat the Lord of the Nazgûl, sustained by the power of their combined courage. The courage of hobbits, and women who refuse to be put in their place, is of course more impressive and inspiring than the courage of wizards. With the help of supernatural powers and giant eagles, Gandalf always seems capable of pulling victory out of his back pocket. He certainly has courage, and he needs it in confronting demons and death. But Gandalf's courage comes in a more calculated form than the courage of the comparatively weak and insignificant hobbits. Gandalf has the wisdom and foresight to know when courage is and is not based on a false hope. While the hobbits could not have completed their journey without Gandalf's wisdom and power, The Lord of the Rings is much more about the unexpected courage of small hands like Frodo's. With that brief introduction, we're ready for Aristotle's philosophical insights into the meaning of courage. To describe courage, both Aristotle and Plato used the word andreia, which means manliness. Aristotle's courage is essentially military courage, the ability to perform acts of valor in the face of ultimate danger. While Plato uses the same word for courage, his definition is broader, more like having the courage to do what's right in general, rather than simply courage on the battlefield. Aristotle says courage is the golden mean with regard to feelings of fear and confidence. Courage lies somewhere between cowardice and recklessness. This implies that it's possible for you to have an overabundance in either confidence or fear, and to be deficient in either confidence or fear. Let's start with fear. Aristotle says you need to fear the right things. There are some things you should fear and some things you shouldn't fear. In other words, courage can't be reduced to fearlessness because fear is built into courage. What kinds of things should you fear then? Aristotle, who lives in what historians call an honor-shame culture, speaks of the fear of disrepute or damage to your honor or reputation as one of the most legitimate fears. We also naturally fear death. However, like all fears, the fear of dishonor and the fear of death can be excessive. When this happens, you're incapable of acting courageously. Back to the ideal of military courage, Aristotle describes death in battle as the most honorable and noblest kind of death. He says that a courageous man is not afraid to suffer a noble death, which is typically a sudden death. He's willing to sacrifice his life for a noble cause, such as defending his country and showing his prowess in battle. To clarify then, you should fear the possibility of a cowardly, dishonorable death, but you should not fear dying in a noble way for a noble cause. In promoting the ideal of military courage, Aristotle emphasizes being willing to sacrifice your life for the greater good and not fearing a noble death. His focus is never on the killing of others. He does not glorify the violence. Aristotle would likely say that you demonstrate just as much courage by crawling onto the battlefield to save a fallen comrade as you do by engaging in hand-to-hand combat on that same battlefield. So how should you understand and manage legitimate fear? Aristotle says that with courage, you have abundant knowledge of the dangers involved in a fearful situation, but you endure fear in the right way and as reason directs for the sake of acting nobly. This is what sustains you as a person of courage, doing the right thing, doing the noble thing in spite of fear. And this is why courage has to be combined with the other virtues. Before you can possess the courage to do what's right, you have to know what's right and what's wrong. Moral virtues such as loyalty, self-sacrifice, integrity, and compassion provide firm principles of truth and noble behavior. They constrain your personal choice by providing the ends of virtue. Based on these already defined ends, practical wisdom figures out the right means to get there, the actions you need to take to be loyal, compassionate, honest, and of course, courageous. This brings us to another question. What's the relation of courage to skill and preparation for battle? Aristotle's response to this question is that with courage, you prepare and train for battle, but you continue fighting even when the hope of victory dims. In contrast, soldiers who don't inherently believe in the cause they're fighting for, we might call them professional soldiers, often turn into cowards when it's clear that they're no longer superior in numbers or in the weapons of war. Optimism is not the same thing as courage, because too often it's inspired by the belief that you won't suffer any harm. In fact, according to Aristotle, courage almost always involves pain, enduring pain for a noble end. For the person of virtue, death involves great physical and spiritual pain, because you love life. You stand to lose a great deal through your willingness to put your own life on the line. Should you fear pain? Yes, but not excessively to the point where you're incapable of acting courageously. In most cases, pain accompanies personal growth. So courage is the happy medium regarding feelings of fear. A person who is deficient in fear is more likely to be reckless and foolhardy, and a person who exceeds in fear is likely to be a coward. But courage is also the mean regarding feelings of confidence. The coward is deficient in confidence, and the reckless person exceeds in confidence. Aristotle observes, however, that most reckless men are actually reckless cowards. They don't stand their ground when encountering something truly fearful. Aristotle describes how the reckless man exceeds in confidence mainly before danger comes. When the danger is imminent, he typically lacks confidence and courage. By contrast, the courageous person is calm before encountering danger and full of courageous energy when the danger actually comes. The greatest courage manifests itself when the danger is not necessarily clear beforehand, but comes suddenly upon you. At that moment, you're less dependent on preparation and more dependent on who you really are. Courage, then, possesses confidence, but it's more about confidence that you're doing the right thing than confidence that you're going to win the battle. It's less about possessing superior strength or believing that you're uniquely qualified to fight, and more about being on the right side. Courageous soldiers act as they do because it's noble, not because they're compelled by their leaders. This is why citizen soldiers are usually the most courageous. They're fighting for a cause they believe in. They're driven to fight by both their heart and their mind. To clarify this point, what clearly amounts to a suicide mission would generally not be founded upon true courage. Reason inspires courage when there's at least a small chance of success, a small glimmer of hope. To summarize Aristotle, courage is founded upon the desire to act nobly. Courage fears what ought to be feared, but not excessively. This implies that courage is not optimism. In other words, courage is not the kind of confidence based primarily on your skill and expertise, but it knows how to manage the fear that comes suddenly when there's little time to get ready for battle. Courage is capable of acting with a full knowledge of a fearful situation. Courage is guided and directed by reason. Finally, courage typically involves some element of pain. But as we've mentioned, pain often leads to character growth. Aristotle sees military courage as the purest form of courage. While we'll be generalizing the principles involved in military courage, we shouldn't lose sight of the ultimate virtues exhibited by true courage on the battlefield. Next time, we'll learn some fascinating things from social science about the definition and meaning of courage. Welcome back to The Character Cure. Courage, Part 2. Before we turn to social science, let's consider for a moment a real-life example of courage. On December 1st, 1955, 42-year-old Rosa Parks was seated near the middle of a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, on her way home from work. As an African-American, she was not allowed to sit in the front of the bus. The discriminatory laws of Alabama also required black passengers to give up their seats to white passengers and stand when the bus became full. On this particular day, the bus quickly filled up and the driver did not hesitate to enforce the unjust laws. He instructed Rosa and the other black passengers to give up their seat to boarding white passengers. While the other three stood up immediately and moved, something inside Rosa revolted at the thought of complying. She courageously refused to move. When the driver threatened to have her arrested, she calmly and quietly replied, "You may do that." Soon, two white police officers arrived, arrested her, drove her to the police station, and booked her into jail. Later that evening, her friends posted bail, and she was released. At the time, many people questioned Rosa's motives for resisting segregation. While she was tired after working all day at her job as a seamstress at the Montgomery department store, Rosa was no more physically tired than usual. Years later, she described that the only tired she was tired of giving in. Because she was an active member of the local chapter of the NAACP, critics suggested that her arrest had been orchestrated by black leaders who wished to use her as a test case for challenging the laws of segregation. But this was not the case. Everything we know about that particular day points to the fact that Rosa Parks found her courage and acted on her own. She was not the first African-American woman to defy bus drivers and face arrest in Montgomery. Among others, two young women had done the same thing on separate occasions earlier that year. But Rosa's arrest aroused and mobilized the black community in a way the others had not. Martin Luther King suggested that this had a lot to do with her character and reputation. In his words, she was ideal for the role assigned to her by history. She was a charming person with a radiant personality, soft-spoken and calm in all situations. Her character was impeccable, and her dedication deep-rooted. All of these traits together made her one of the most respected people in the black community. Indeed, the entire community, including church leaders, taxicab drivers, and bus riders, rallied around Ms. Parks in organizing the Montgomery bus boycott. After 13 months, the Supreme Court ruled against bus segregation, and Rosa was finally able to ride at the front of the bus without having to give up her seat. Her peaceful resistance proved to be an important catalyst in propelling forward the civil rights movement in the United States. Let's consider now what made Rosa's act so courageous. First, and perhaps most important, she knew that her actions were reasonable, that she was on the side of justice. Through her involvement with the NAACP, she had plenty of opportunities to reflect on the injustice of segregation and the rationale behind civil disobedience. Unjust laws ought to be resisted. Rosa's courage was sustained by the knowledge that she was doing the right thing. Her emotions were under control, and her mind was prepared to act when her moment of truth arrived. Second, Rosa's courageous actions carried significant risk. While she received nearly unanimous support from the black community, she lost her job at the department store and was frequently harassed because of her involvement in the bus boycott, even experiencing death threats. This forced Rosa and her family to move to Detroit within 2 years. Third, while her courage was sustained by hope, the odds were clearly against her. As a mature married woman, she calmly faced the consequences of her bold actions with a degree of confidence, but without any guarantee of success. She did not possess the foresight to know whether her actions would lead to any sort of positive change. Others had followed a similar course of action before, and little had come of it. In the long run, of course, Rosa Parks was widely respected and honored for her courage. In 1965, she was offered a secure position on the congressional staff of newly elected Representative John Conyers of Michigan. In 1996, President Bill Clinton awarded her the Presidential Medal of Freedom. 3 years later, she received the Congressional Gold Medal. She was honored for the selfless courage and leadership qualities she displayed throughout her life. With Aristotle's views on courage and the real-world example of Rosa Parks as a foundation, let's see what modern social science has to teach us about courage in the 21st century. One of the best recent sources I've found on courage is the Journal of Positive Psychology. The field of positive psychology tries to understand character strengths that enable people and communities to thrive. In April of 2007, scholars contributed 6 articles to a special issue focused on courage. The first article examines people's implicit theories of courage. In other words, when people describe actions as courageous, either their own or the actions of others, what unspoken characteristics do they have in mind? A research team led by Yale University's Christopher Raitt studied samples of students at 2 very different institutions, Yale and the United States Air Force Academy. What they found was a bit surprising. First, results from the 2 institutions were remarkably similar, with no significant differences in student responses. Second, gender differences were also minimal, with men and women defining courage in similar ways. This is somewhat unexpected, given the stereotypical views of courage as a masculine virtue. Remember, Plato and Aristotle used andreia, the Greek word for manliness, to describe courage. Before diving deeper into this particular study, it's worth mentioning that courage continues to be defined in many different ways by philosophers, writers, psychologists, and other public figures. Definitions range from Hemingway's simple expression of grace under pressure to the lengthy but precise description of courage published by the American Psychological Association. The cognitive process of defining risk, identifying and considering alternative actions, and choosing to act in spite of potential negative consequences in an effort to obtain good for self or others, recognizing that this perceived good may not be realized. Close quote. In their study, Raitt and his collaborators found a consensus surrounding four components of courage. First, an element of risk. Second, fear, which seems to be more important in evaluating your own courage than the courage of others. Third, a noble or worthy purpose. And fourth, there must be some intentionality or deliberation. So there we have it, as close as we can probably come to a common understanding of courage as a characteristic that deliberately embraces risk and fear for a noble purpose. As a general definition, Aristotle would probably be okay with it. Now on to another study from the Department of Psychology at Clemson University in South Carolina. Cynthia Puri and Robin Kowalski explore the distinction between general and personal courage. They begin by referring to the VIA, or Values and Action Inventory of Character Strengths Associated with Courage. The VIA Survey on Character is published by a nonprofit organization in Cincinnati, Ohio, which says that four emotional strengths serve as the foundation for courage: bravery, persistence, honesty or integrity, and zest or vitality. This fourth strength is perhaps the most insightful. Puri and her colleagues point out that vitality can mean something more than energy and enthusiasm for life. For many courageous people, vitality is the ability to act in the face of physical or mental illness. So, the Clemson study begins with bravery, persistence, integrity, and vitality, and then adds one more important element to the foundation of courage: hope. They like to describe courage as hopeful persistence. In a second article, Pierre and Kowalski join with Jana Spearman to look deeper into the distinction between general and personal courage. General courage is the type of courage that you would normally ascribe to other people. It's usually perceived as a monumental effort compared to the way most people would act in a particular situation. Personal courage, on the other hand, is the way you might ascribe courage to yourself in the context of your own personal limitations. We've already touched on one important difference between the two. Personal courage seems to be more associated with fear. When you look at the monumental courage of others, you don't typically emphasize the element of fear. What you see in others is a fearless and confident courage. But your personal courage tends to be more about acting in the face of difficulty, fear, vulnerability, and anxiety. This is a really important contribution to our understanding of courage: the mental and emotional challenges that accompany everyday courage. Puri and her Clemson colleagues found no significant effect of gender on the way people understand general or personal courage, with the exception, perhaps, that females tend to focus a bit more on non-physical difficulty in describing personal courage. Examples might include courageously dealing with a family crisis or a relationship, or performing in public. In another study, in this same special edition of the Journal of Positive Psychology, a group of psychologists from Munich, Germany, sort out the distinction between what they call helping behavior and civil courage. Tobias Greitmeier and his colleagues explain that helping behavior is more about empathy and social responsibility, without involving a lot of personal risk, and in fact with a greater chance of social rewards. Examples of helping behavior include lending some class notes to a fellow student and intervening to stop a fight where the perpetrator is relatively weak and incapable of offering much resistance. People are less likely to engage in helping behavior if they're in a bad mood, or if there is a large number of other people present who can help. By way of contrast, this study defines civil courage as brave behavior accompanied by anger and indignation, which intends to enforce societal and ethical norms without considering one's own social costs. So civil courage includes being willing to risk negative social consequences. Interestingly, Greitemeyer and his German colleagues found that civil courage is less about empathy and more about the desire to do the right thing. It's also less dependent on the mood of the courageous person, and it doesn't matter how many bystanders are present. One of the main takeaways from this study, then, is that courage is about doing the right thing regardless of the consequences and regardless of your emotional state of mind. In a study conducted at the U.S. Military Academy, Sean Hanna and his fellow researchers explore what they call the subjective act and experience of courage. They want to know how courage is experienced, rather than simply how it's defined or perceived. This is an important distinction. In a nutshell, these researchers propose that true courage is present when you perceive risk, experience fear, and overcome those fears to act. As a subjective experience, courage can be cultivated or instilled in others through the example of courageous leaders. Hanna concludes that to act courageously, you ultimately need to possess the self-confidence, inner stability, and strength required by difficult and often painful circumstances. He and his colleagues observe that courage is built on positive traits such as openness, conscientiousness, hope, and resiliency. But courageous actors also need a strong sense of purpose and a clear set of values, which provide the framework for responding in emergency situations. In another study from Columbia University, Stephanie Fagan-Jones and Elizabeth Midlarsky investigate the courageous altruism shown by Holocaust rescuers. Predictably, they found that these individuals possessed heightened forms of empathy, social responsibility, and moral reasoning. The altruistic rescuers had a clear sense that they were doing the right thing. They were generally older than bystanders, with some exceptions. Somewhat surprising to me was that most rescuers seemed to be fully integrated and contributing members of society. They were not outsiders or marginalized people who had little to lose by helping Jewish families in opposition to the Nazis. This leads to the most compelling discovery of Fagan-Jones and Midlarsky's study. The Holocaust rescuers had a propensity to take tremendous risks on themselves and often their families. In other words, they believed enough in what they were doing to put their lives and their reputations on the line. Passive bystanders clearly lacked this essential element of courage. Now, it's interesting to compare this article's discussion of empathy with the article on civil courage and helping behavior. Greitemeyer and his colleagues seem to downplay the importance of empathy. They conclude that the willingness to embrace social risks is much more a predictor of courage than mere empathy. Fagan-Jones and Midlarsky almost appear to reach the same conclusion. Risk-taking is paramount as an element of courageous altruism. But they conclude that the monumental courage of the few heroic rescuers required empathy as well. These heroes needed empathy, moral clarity, and, of course, the propensity to take personal risks in the face of gross injustice and suffering. Now let's take a step back and look at an article published in the Harvard Business Review. In this article, Kathleen Reardon, a USC business professor, describes courage as a skill or a set of skills that can be mastered by business professionals. She defines courage in business as a special kind of calculated risk-taking in your career. It involves making intelligent gambles that require careful, deliberate decisions over a period of time, in a way that avoids committing career suicide. For Reardon, courageous business leaders understand six processes that enable them to make bold moves to benefit themselves and their organization. These are the processes involved in what she calls courage calculation. First, you set primary and secondary goals. Second, you determine the importance of achieving your goals. You keep your eyes fixed on what you ultimately want to achieve, and you're willing to wait on some other things. In other words, you make sound judgments about what's worth standing and fighting for. Third, you figure out how to tip the power balance in your favor. Fourth, you excel in weighing risks against benefits, choosing risks that are more likely to pay off. Fifth, you select the proper time for action. And sixth, you develop contingency plans in the event things don't work out in the way you had hoped. This article has great value, especially for people who have a difficult time taking risks in their career. I appreciate its practical, real-world focus. But I think it's important to contrast Reardon's description of courage in business with a type of courage examined in the Journal of Positive Psychology. Courage as a skill set that helps you climb the ladder of success in business is obviously different from courage on the battlefield or courage in rescuing potential Holocaust victims. Now, my purpose here is not to start pointing fingers and saying this businesswoman or that athlete isn't showing true courage, that they're merely being, say, helpful or persistent or passionate or prudent. These traits are all extremely important and valuable in themselves. Enlightened forms of self-interest have meaningful roles to play in your life, and very often kindness, perseverance, and integrity are all you need to act appropriately in a given situation. But sometimes, and this is the critical point, you actually need courage when you want to do the right thing in spite of heavy personal risk, paralyzing fear, mental and emotional instability, and very little chance of success. I believe that every life calls for the kind of courage we're discussing at one point or another. In reality, life may present you with more opportunities to display true courage than you're willing or prepared to embrace. But courage is one of the keys to a happy and fulfilling life. So let's summarize what we've learned from social science regarding courage. For the most part, the studies we've explored have affirmed Aristotle's general framework for understanding courage. But we've gleaned a few important points to refine that understanding. First, people in the 21st century generally agree that courage is made up of four components: an element of risk, a sense of fear, a noble or worthy purpose, and finally, courage has to be intentional, based on a deliberate decision to act. Most of the commendable things you do in life don't quite pass the bar you would typically set for courage. And our purpose in defining courage in a rigorous way is not to diminish the value of everyday kindness or social responsibility. The purpose of defining courage is to inspire you to do the right thing when you do face risky circumstances that strike you with fear, when you face your own Rosa Parks moment. Second, there's an important distinction between general and personal courage. General courage is the type of fearless, heroic courage that you perceive in others. Personal courage, which is the type you would ascribe to yourself, is more intertwined with fear, anxiety, vulnerability, and mental instability. In other words, personal courage is not reserved for the invincible hero who never struggles with self-doubt. When called upon, courage finds a way to act in the face of personal limitations. Third, courageous actors, such as Holocaust rescuers, are willing to risk irreparable harm for what they believe is right. This type of monumental courage requires empathy, compassion, and moral clarity. Sometimes it also calls for a willingness to sacrifice the things most dear to you in standing up for justice and uniting with a noble cause, even when it's clear that you have very little chance to succeed. Next time, we'll discuss a few practical tips on developing greater courage in our personal lives. Welcome back to The Character Cure. Courage, Part 3. Let's conclude with some practical tips on cultivating greater courage in your life. As with other virtues, such as practical wisdom, it seems like we've set the bar pretty high. So we'll try not to lose touch with real life as we compare it to the ideal life. Here's the first tip. Know what you personally stand for. In its essence, courage is about doing the right thing, doing the noble thing. Now, the only way you can possibly be disposed to risk life and limb, to risk your reputation and honor, is to know you're acting for a noble cause. What are you personally willing to sacrifice for? If you haven't consciously reasoned through the answer to this question, you're less capable of displaying courage in your life. You have to know what you stand for and who you stand with. A closely related tip, and this might sound a little corny, is to practice doing the right thing. Courage is developed by doing the right thing even when you're experiencing anxiety or feeling the effects of other personal limitations. Overcoming self-doubt and fear usually doesn't happen overnight. You have to work at it, gaining greater confidence in your ability to choose the right each time you succeed. In cultivating courage, remember that your personal golden mean can only be discovered by pushing back against your areas of weakness. Of course, in our discussion of practical wisdom, we emphasize that sometimes it's not easy to determine what's the right thing to do. Sometimes the demands of one or more virtues conflict with each other. We might even say that courage alone by itself presents a built-in conflict. On one hand, it's about standing up for people or principles that you believe in. On the other, it's about the willingness to sacrifice things you value. Resisting and violating unjust laws risks your personal freedom. Monumental courage on the battlefield risks everything for a noble cause. In other words, in your quest to display courage in your life, don't be too hasty or too eager to risk those things that are most dear to you. In many cases, practical wisdom will instead urge patience, long-suffering, and persuasion. Tip number 3. Remember that not every courageous act is successful in terms of righting a wrong, conquering the forces of evil, or rescuing the innocent. For this reason, you have to give yourself permission to fail. This doesn't mean you give yourself a license to be reckless and risk your life or reputation unwisely. Remember, courage is the happy medium between cowardice and recklessness. Courage acts as directed by reason. I keep emphasizing this because most of the time, reason will tell you to avoid risking your life and other things that are most dear to you. Legitimate fears will also steer you away from taking foolish risks. However, when reason does direct, you need to accept that courage brings with it the risk of failure and the strong possibility of pain. Tip number 4. If you want to cultivate the virtue of courage, it's a good idea to associate with people who are themselves courageous. And as you develop courage, you can inspire others to follow the same course. So there we have 4 tips for cultivating courage. First, know what you stand for. Second, use practical wisdom in doing the right thing. Third, give yourself permission to fail. And fourth, hang out with courageous people. I'll end with a personal challenge. Think about something you fear that prevents you at times from doing the right thing. It may be as simple as sharing an outside-the-box idea in front of a group of overbearing colleagues at work, or risking the possibility of rejection in a relationship. You may have an antagonistic friend or colleague who needs to be confronted about their behavior, but you just haven't had the nerve to do it. You may feel insecure about a particular talent you've tried to develop over the years, and this prevents you from developing it further. My challenge is to set aside your fears and do the right thing. Such an action doesn't need to be monumental. It could be a small act of kindness or an honest response to a friend. These are the acts that cultivate a higher level of courage, preparing your heart and mind for something more monumental when courage calls. To conclude, let's repeat an observation we made earlier. In spite of our familiarity with the virtue of courage, it may be one of the most overlooked elements of a happy and fulfilling life. For most of us, complacency and risk aversion are the norm. You and I probably miss more opportunities than we realize to embrace the kind of courage that makes the world a better place. Thanks for joining me. For more resources on character education, check out my website at charactercure.com.